Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Well, Matt, here we are sitting in the podcast studio and I'm holding a copy of
something with words on it that you can't understand.
Which I can't understand, but looking at the cover, it looks like Deeper Places in French.
That's right.
And very exciting, actually. These just arrived today across my desk, and we've managed to get Deeper Places, your book on the spirituality of the Psalms, published in French. And that's two languages now, or three, actually, of course, English, but we've also got Dutch and French. So take that home, and
I'll have to give a copy to my mum. She's the only one that I know that speaks French.
I was going to say, otherwise Google Translate or something or other. Yeah. I'm sure he said what you said.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. No, I did get it checked. I promise it's been peer reviewed to make sure of that. But very exciting. And if you haven't checked out Matt's book, Deeper Places, Spirituality of the Psalms, I'd really encourage you to have a look out for that. You can find a way to get to that book through our thrivetoday.tv website. But Matt, we are jumping into episode 160 of Thrive Deeper.
We've got some rich Bible study today. This is your half an hour of Bible study for the fortnight, and we've got some rich stuff for you.
Yeah, it'll be interesting if we can get this into half an hour. But we're looking at Isaiah, and we're going to really try to cover chapters 1 to 12-ish if we get there. And of course, Isaiah was prophesying really in the era 740 to 700 BC, largely in the time where we still had what was the end of the two kingdom era with Israel in the northern kingdom and Judah in the southern kingdom. And his prophetic words were largely directed towards the leaders of Jerusalem and Judah. That was really where he was speaking. We know that at this stage, Assyria had defeated Israel, the northern kingdom, and Aram had tried to make an alliance with them to then come and take Judah. They'd asked Judah to join them in an alliance, and Judah had refused to. And so then they started the siege towards Jerusalem and Judah as well. And in this time, Isaiah had been warning Hezekiah, who was the king of Judah at the time, about the nation's rebellion against God, the nation both of Israel and the impending judgment that was coming in or had come to them, but also what was going to be coming to Judah. And when he issues these warnings to Hezekiah, we do see a revival of sorts.
That's the difference between the northern and the southern kingdoms at this stage, is that the southern kingdoms actually listen. I mean, the northern kingdom just consistently will not listen. And in fact, it's interesting to note, the more apostate they become, actually, God doesn't turn his back on them. He actually sends more prophets.
Dials it up.
And Isaiah is a key figure that speaks to the northern kingdom. But of course, they don't listen. And the southern kingdom does listen, and they are, at least for the next 100 years, they continue.
And we see really God's miraculous saving of the city Jerusalem when it's besieged by Sennacherib.
Sennacherib,
when he marched against Judah. And Isaiah urged the king to trust God to defend them, and sure enough he did in a miraculous way.
So, these are incredibly, incredibly turbulent times in the ancient world. And when you have turbulent times in the ancient world, they're really, really turbulent. Insecurity. It's within Isaiah's ministry that the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes of Israel are going to disappear. This is a time of great cataclysm, and he's anticipating this.
Exactly right. And he preaches that God's judgment was actually going to come through the hands of the other nations. The nations surrounding them were actually going to be God's hand of judgment. And largely that was around, so Assyria and later Babylon, obviously. And largely that was going to be focused on the nation's idolatry, Israel and Judah's idolatry and the oppression of the poor. They're big themes through this. And the last thing before we jump in at chapter 1 there, Matt, I want to reflect on too is, having just come out of Micah where we've seen a prophet sort of the judgment, but then there's also these sections of hope, talking about it's not forever. There is hope in the future. And as you say, this is about restoration for people.
That's right. All that whole pattern throughout the biblical prophets, the constant references to hope. There's these oracles of judgment. It's as though God is pruning back the tree, but there's always hope beyond that. And one of the important themes actually through the prophets, and this is particularly the case with Isaiah, is the theme of a remnant. God, in a sense, is going to prune back the tree, but there will always be a remnant, and from that remnant will grow essentially the future community of God that ultimately is going to be the church, from that stump of Jesse, as it's so even in chapter 11, when it talks about the stump of Jesse, you think a stump, man, that this thing is really going to get cut back, but there's going to be new shoots from that stump.
And visually, there's a great way for us in Australia, particularly because of forest fires, and we see forests completely destroyed, and then you come back and you know, when you see it on TV, they're filming a year later, you see these little green shoots coming out of what looked like was completely destroyed. So there's an interesting picture there that, and there's quite a lot of kind of horticultural illustrations through this part of Isaiah anyway. So let's jump into
the first five chapters are, I was thinking, Stu, a little bit like a sort of movie trailer, you know, a movie trailer where you have all the best bits. And it's interesting because you would think that chapter six, this amazing account of the calling of Isaiah, you would think that that would be right at the start. But you have these five chapters of oracles in which basically you get a condensed version of the kind of thing that God is saying throughout at least the first half of the book. So, you know, it addresses their rebellion, and, you know, you have this interplay with oracles of rebellion, but then you have, for example, in chapter 2, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord. And so, and this is actually a theme that runs right through the book of Isaiah. You know, this idea of the ultimate fulfillment of God's covenant, because of course the covenant with Abraham was that all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. And so the idea of all of the nations streaming to Zion is an important theme throughout this book, because it shows that ultimately God's people, as God committed, the plan that God committed to was that these people would be a light to the Gentiles, a light to the nations.
Even though the people hadn't kept their end of the covenant.
No, that's right.
And, you know, now I think through chapters 1 and 2, there's a big part of, you know, essentially it's God's ultimatum, obey, and that would bring forgiveness and restoration, or continue in disobedience, which is going to result in destruction. And that's really the big part of that first part of chapters 1 and 2, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And you get in, you know, great picture language here in chapter 5, and because I want to do a slightly deeper dive on chapter 6 here. But you get this idea of the vineyard and the, and you know that he established this beautiful vineyard and then went looking for fruit and found it completely fruitless and so forth. And let's jump into chapter 6, Stu, because I want to do a little bit of a deep dive on this one. It begins chapter 6, verse 1, in the year that King Uzziah died. Now, this is important because King Uzziah was quite a successful king. It was a time of prosperity. And this this leads to, I guess, the question of, well, what now? And there's a sense of insecurity too with the changing over of the throne. But at the same time, you've got the king of Assyria coming in. And the king of Aram, and so you've got this complex political situation. One king has died, but it's in the context of the king dying that Isaiah says, "I saw the Lord high and exalted, seated on a throne." And so, you know, he's in one sense, one king has died, but in the context of that, he sees the true king.
The real king.
Yeah. And it's interesting here that he says that he sees the Lord. Now, you know, we're almost prepared here to see Yahweh, to see God. However, there's a sense in which any glimpse of God is kind of blocked here. Even the seraphim, we're going to meet the seraphim in a moment. But even the seraphim hovering around Yahweh, they even hide their faces in their wings. And so
they have six wings, and two of them are just to hide their faces.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so in a sense, what is described is more what's happening in the vicinity around God. There's no direct description of Yahweh himself here. But he's high and exalted. Now, he's seated on a throne, and as soon as we see the word throne there, it's not just talking about authority. This is judgment. This looks like judgment day, you know. So this is a judgment scene here. And it says, and the train of his robe filled the temple. And you could think of this as like the hem of his robe. So what actually filled the temple was God, in a sense. Yeah. And so it's an amazing vision here. Yeah. Above him, it says, were seraphim. Now, this is interesting, Stu. Seraphim. Now, you would perhaps expect maybe cherubim, and I'll you know,
unpack the difference.
Yeah, let me unpack the difference. Now, the thing about cherubim, of course, were, you know, guarding the way that the cherubim with the flaming sword, guarding the way to the tree of life. They're these sort of guardian angels in that in that sense, guardians of the holiness of God. Seraphim are associated with judgment. Now, seraphim comes from the word fire, but it's actually used of serpents, snakes. In fact, it's the word that's used of the snakes that God sent into the camp in the book of Numbers when he sent serpents in to bite the people as an act of judgment.
Yep.
And then, of course, the raising up of the bronze serpent and so forth. So kind of connection with judgment here.
Yeah.
It's actually, so they're actually not unknown in the ancient world, these kind of snake-like creatures that are symbols of judgment, but also kind of guardians as well. So, for example, if you look at a picture of Tutankhamun, for example, and you look at his headdress, on the top of his head, you'll see, of his headdress, you'll see a serpent, a snake.
Right. Yeah, right.
That's like a seraph, you know, seraph in for the Egyptians, and you know that's kind of a guardian creature. Now, the interesting thing here is they're not guarding Yahweh; they're actually protecting themselves in one sense. They are, you know, Yahweh here doesn't need to be guarded. So it's interesting the way that this vision of Isaiah, the way that it draws on imagery that was probably very familiar, because these seraphs are quite familiar in various imagery on pottery and so forth in the ancient Near East, and so they, you know, these sort of stinging vipers or so forth that are, you know, symbols of, you know, protection, judgment, so forth, and here probably the sense is this is judgment is coming because, you know, God is coming. There are these seraphs, these seraphim.
They're poised.
And they're poised, you know, they're poised in judgment. Mm. And so it's a scary kind of thing. Now, the interesting, they're winged seraphim. Again, not unknown in ancient Near Eastern iconography. But they're covering their faces and their feet. So they are responding to the holiness of God. Mm. They're covering their faces because they cannot look upon the holiness of God. Mm. And they're covering their feet. It's interesting. Not quite sure why.
I couldn't figure that out. I was waiting for you to tell me.
They're covering their feet. Yeah. It may be, again, it's this holy ground thing that the feet are associated with. I mean, you know, they're serpents, but they've somehow got feet. But there is this sense of holy ground and perhaps covering something. It's been suggested too, they're covering their feet. They're sort of disavowing any prerogative to walk in their own ways or whatever. That's, you know, one suggestion that's been made. And anyway, so they're calling to one another. Mm. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory.
Yeah.
It's amazing, amazing song that they're singing here. Now, what does holy mean in this context? And I think we sometimes think we know what these terms are. Now, it's always used of deity, and it's used for this sense of a deity being exalted, highly exalted in some sense. So the triple use of this word indicates that God, holy, 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 that he is set apart from All else, in fact, all other spiritual beings that may be called gods, he's completely set apart. Mm. So set apartness is the key. It's the transcendence, the absolute transcendence of God. And so the second line adds meaning to that, because this is not just a local deity. This is his whole earth is filled with the glory of God. Mm. And you know, Isaiah's going to talk about the glory of the Lord covering the earth as the waters cover the sea.
Yeah.
Now, it says at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the thresholds shook the temple and it was filled with smoke. This is, again, smoke is a symbol of the presence of God.
Yeah.
And then Isaiah's response to this is interesting. Now, here, in a sense, Isaiah is part of his people. He doesn't separate himself from his people. Mm. He says, "Woe to me, I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." So he has this "I'm going to die" moment, because I belong to this unclean people, and the judgment sits with me as well. So he's actually acknowledging what everyone else should be acknowledging at this stage.
Yeah.
And again through the book of Isaiah, the call is, if only you would acknowledge your sin, if only you would acknowledge and turn back to me and seek forgiveness, then you would be cleansed. That's the consistent promise through Isaiah. So you have Isaiah enacting that himself, his immediate response as he is confronted with this holy, holy, holy God is this moment of deep, deep penitence, almost shock, you know. Mm. So he shows a sort of a tenderness of heart, and a responsiveness to God in the midst of this. Now, as a result, it says one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal. Now, these are seraphim who these fiery, you know, the association with fire and with judgment, but they come to Isaiah. Says he flew to me with a coal in his hand, which he'd taken with tongs from the altar with it. He touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin is atoned for."
Mm.
Now, it's interesting that there is this reference to unclean lips. Why do you have any
idea?
It's interesting that it refers to that. And I think it shows the... Well,
because Isaiah said it before that too, remember, because he says, "I am a man of unclean lips."
Yeah, that's right. And I live amongst a people of unclean lips. That's the way that that these people, you know, are described. And this is... You know, this is a very verbal culture, and the idea of speaking is a very central idea in biblical revelation. God speaks and he creates. Blessing and cursing are, you know, are key. Making vows, bringing praise to God.
Mm.
And so the fruit of one's lips actually is a key expression of the heart.
Right.
And, you know, there'd been a lot of giving lip service to God at this stage, a lot of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
He's going to...
False prophets.
That's right. False prophets speaking lies, a lot of lies, a lot of hypocrisy and so forth. And so, you know, this is part of this unclean lips thing.
Yeah.
It's just interesting that he highlights that aspect of it. So, Isaiah, with the coal, the burning coal, the sense of the cleansing of the fire, and also the idea of coal, you know, burning coal, being the presence of God, it's this cleansing effect of the presence of God, because fire is always a symbol of the purifying presence of God. And so he says, "Your sin is atoned for." And then it's interesting from here, he hears a voice. The voice of Yahweh, and remember, wherever you get the Lord in capital letters is Yahweh. Now, here it says the Lord, which is Adonai. "I heard the voice of Adonai, the Lord, saying, 'Whom shall I send and who will go for us?'" And it's interesting here too, because we've got this picture now of the heavenly court, as it were. And there are other scenes like this with this sense of this heavenly court, and who is going to go now?
Yeah, yeah.
And Isaiah is given this opportunity to respond, and he says, "Here I am, send me."
Mm. The other interesting thing is, and this happens in Revelation, who should I send? Who will go for us?
Yeah.
It's just
that's right.
This whole kind of the multi-Trinitarian kind of sense of, is that what that is? Or?
Well, I think most probably you're talking about a heavenly court.
Right, okay.
That's quite a common image even throughout the throughout the Old Testament. Yeah, yeah. So this, you know, God in the presence of all of, you know, it's like in Revelation, the living creatures and so forth. So, so he says, and this is strange now, but it's part of this judgment. Now what happens, you know, here is God in all of his glory. Mm. And immediately you get this polarization effect. This is, you see this in the ministry of Jesus. When Jesus came, he polarized people, brought out either the really the best or really the worst, not much in between.
Yep.
You know, polarization is the effect when the brighter the light, the darker the shadows. And you get this here because he says in verse 9, he said, go tell this people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never never perceiving. He says to Isaiah, verse 10, make the heart of this people calloused, make their ears dull and close their eyes, otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed.
Mm.
So they're so set. He's saying, push them further.
Yeah.
Actually, by sending Isaiah, it's going to further harden their hearts because they're going to hear the truth, but it's going to actually going to push them more the other way.
Which is so, very interesting, very similar to what we saw happen with the Egyptians when Moses went in
and said,
you know, and God hardened their hearts so that they wouldn't listen.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not that, and of course, Pharaoh's heart was already hard.
Yes. Well, as these people.
But God is compounding it, you know, bringing it to its, you know, its natural end. Mm. And this is a principle that Jesus talked about when he says those who have will be given more and those who do not have, even what they have will be taken away from him.
Yeah.
And then he quotes these verses in Matthew chapter 13. Jesus quotes these verses because they say in Matthew 13, the disciples ask Jesus, why are you speaking in these riddles, parables? We think Jesus spoke in parables to make things clear, actually.
Yeah.
It actually veiled things.
Yes.
And he says, well, because to those who have will be given more, but those who do not have, even what they have will be taken away. And he's talking about, because he talks about those who have ears to hear and eyes to see.
Mm.
And he's talking about this willingness. If you are willing to understand, I'll give you more understanding. You'll see more, right? If you're willing to see, you'll see more.
Mm.
But if you're not willing to see, even what sight you have will be taken away from you.
Mm.
And so Isaiah's ministry is going to have this effect. I wonder if Isaiah's regretting saying, here I am, send me at this stage.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because that's a real natural, I guess. You know, if we continue ignoring the prompting of the Holy Spirit in our lives, we dull our senses to actually hear God speaking to us ultimately.
Yeah, that's right.
And so we find ourselves, the more we ignore, the more we turn away, the more we decide to not heed what God's saying to us, actually we start to lose the ability to actually hear
God's
direction in our life.
Yeah.
You know, and this kind of points to that as well, I think.
That's right. Yeah. And so Isaiah, you know, this is, imagine hearing this. Isaiah naturally says, Lord, how long is this going to happen? How long is this? Like, are they never going to actually hear? I mean, he's concerned about God's purpose here because God's people are central to God's purpose. It's not like God's going to say, I'll just sweep you out of the sight and I'll just do it directly.
Yeah,
no, God had committed himself to working through people because he committed the rule of the earth to people and in particular to this people. You know, he'd made an everlasting covenant with this people that through them, through the children of Abraham, that blessing would come to the ends of the earth. So Isaiah's a bit concerned here. How long is this people who are so central to your purpose not going to listen? And he says, until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted, the fields are ruined and ravaged, until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will be laid waste. But as the terebinth and oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be a stump in the land.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he's going to bring this thing until it's been pruned right down to a stump. And he's going to speak in chapter 11 about the stump of Jesse. We're going to come back to this stump.
Yes.
It's going to... That's how drastic this has to get. Now, this is necessary for the future of God's purpose. And notice here, this is the holy, holy, holy God. This is the impression I got from this, G. You know, this is when the effect that reading this kind of stuff has on me is that it adjusts my heart to the reality of God.
Yeah.
When our hearts, I think, naturally go a little grey, you know, but it's like, wow, this is like black and white stuff here. Mm. And the issues are really heavy here. Mm. And I found this very sobering to come back to this again, this really polarised and
recognising the awesomeness and holiness of, you know, God. It's like we can, you know, make God fit into our box, but this is a God who is beyond our comprehension.
That's right.
In reality.
And he is holy, 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 and he is going to vindicate his holiness. Yeah. You know, it's like there's so much grace and compassion and love for his people, but at the end of the day, God says, I am holy and I am God and I am the judge and you don't mess with me.
Yeah.
But the moment you turn back, I will receive you. Now, at this stage, he's actually going to push them further into their rebellion because he's going to prune this tree, and that's what he does. Now, in chapter 7, as we move over into chapter 7, that's where he addresses this immediate situation that you referred to where Assyria is on its way down. The king of the northern kingdom, Pekah, and Rezin, King Rezin of Aram, have entered into an alliance, and they come to the southern kingdom and to Jotham.
Yep.
To Ahaz, I should say.
Yes.
They come to Ahaz and they say, hey, you come and join us. Come and join. We're going to stand against the Assyrians. Yep. Isaiah says, no, don't do that. Now, what I think at this stage, it seems like Ahaz was backing the Assyrians. He's thinking as if they're going to beat the Assyrians,
logical.
Yeah, that was the right kind of idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, Isaiah actually comes up with a third option. It's don't enter into this alliance with the northern kingdom, with the Arameans. Mm. Now, they're going to be really, you know, they're not going to be happy about that because they need this alliance to survive against the Assyrians. But, you know, Isaiah says, but neither do you need to trust in the Assyrians. Neither do you need to make an alliance with them because you can trust in God. And as it says down in verse 9, if you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Now, an interesting prophetic thing happens here. And that is the role of children, Stu.
Yes.
Did you notice that when you read this?
Yes, I did notice that, yes.
That children, there's four different children between here and chapter 9 that play a really important, they become prophetic symbols.
Yes.
And the reason for children is because children represent the future.
The next generation.
That's right. Yeah. Children really are the future.
Mm.
And so the symbolism of these different children and what they're called is going to be symbolic of the future. So so when the Lord says to Isaiah to go and meet with these, to go and meet Ahaz, he says, go out, you and your son, and his son's name is Shear Jashub, which means a remnant will return.
Yep.
So that's the first, this is the first key name. And again, this is a promise that, you know, a faithful remnant will return. God is, you know, yes, the storm is coming through. As you said before, the firestorm is coming through, but it's not going to kill everything. A remnant's going to return. So he actually goes out with this son, Shear Jashub, who kind of symbolizes this this promise, that what's in the future.
Mm.
And they go and meet with Ahab and he says, look, Aram and the northern kingdom are going to be completely destroyed, so don't back them. But listen, you need to trust in the Lord.
Mm.
If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all.
Mm.
And then he says, because Ahaz had probably already backed the Assyrians and is thinking, I don't know if I really want to trust that much. I'm just going to back the Assyrians. Because then in verse 10, it says, again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. Mm. Ahaz, feigning piety somewhat, says, I will not ask, I will not put the Lord to the test.
Mm.
Well, no, but God just said, ask for a sign. Yeah. And I think...
Was that because he didn't want to be backed into a corner?
Yeah, I don't think he wanted to be backed into a corner. Yeah. That's right. I think he'd already made his decision.
That's what I thought too.
And his policy was set.
It's like, if I get a sign, then what am I meant to do?
I know.
I'm actually better not to have a sign.
That's right.
And you know, that can be true of us sometimes. I'd rather not know because then I don't feel any accountability.
Yeah, that's right.
Actually, there is accountability. So
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then this is where we meet the next symbolic child. Then Isaiah said, "Hear now, you house of David, is it not enough to try the patience of humans? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. He will be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the right. To reject the wrong and choose the right. For before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings that you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring you and your people and on the house of your father time like any other." Anyway, it goes on like this. So in other words, a child is going to be born probably, and I think within the royal household. So, you know, a Davidic child is going to be born, another one to the line of David. And within the time that he grows up and is old enough to tell between right and wrong, probably roughly maybe the age of sort of 14, this is going to be fulfilled.
Yep.
You know, so this is the sign. This is the sign. So you know this child gets born to royal household, but by the time he gets to this age, you are going to be delivered. Actually, I might put a correction on that. I think it's even before that. Yeah, he'll be eating curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. I'm going from the traditional Jewish idea, the adulthood 14.
It's only 4 or 5.
No, that's right. Yeah. No, this is only a few years old. Mm. Yeah. So within a few years, pretty much. He's going to, there is going to be this, this cataclysm is going to come through. And then he talks about that it's going to be Assyria. Assyria is going to be the Lord's instrument for the judgment on the people. So there is this Emmanuel child here. Now, I had a conversation with a Jewish woman once, and she said, the thing I don't understand about, you know, she referred to this verse. She said it's clearly talking about this day. It's not even talking about
Jesus.
It's clearly talking about something in this day. And that is actually true. You know what I mean? Now, her point was this clearly is not meant to predict the Messiah. The point that I would make, though, is that, yes, perhaps it's not necessarily meant to be predictive, but it is used prefiguratively. There's a difference between predicting and prefiguring. Mm. And this is a prefigurement. So Matthew refers to this verse here. He quotes from the verse about Emmanuel and so forth, because he sees there a prefigurement, a prophetic prefigurement of, even though it's not explicitly necessarily predicting, though I think in a double fulfillment sense, you could see a predictive element to this here, because because Emmanuel means God with us. And, you know, this is the sign that God fulfills his word and so forth, that God is faithful and God is with us.
This was a question. I mean, we talked briefly about this before we jumped in, and that was exactly kind of my, and I, you know, for me, I was thinking, well, we've got to remember also God's outside of time and space. And so he's seeing all of this stuff happening simultaneously, you know. So he's thinking about what's coming in the
getting
future.
Complicated there,
and also talking about what's happening in the moment now, you know. And anyway,
it's known as prophetic foreshortening. It's like the illustration that's used when you look at a mountain range and you might be looking at mountain peaks that are you know, like 50-100 miles apart, and yet you see them as like they're all together in the one vista. The next child that we meet is this child with this classic name, Stu, in chapter 8. He names this child Meir Shalal Hashbaz, which means, let me just get this, quick to the booty, you know, to the spoil, you know. It's basically, it's the invitation to oppressors to come in and just lay waste, you know. Because again, the idea here is that God is using Assyria as his instrument of discipline upon his people. So in a sense, the name of this child stands for God's call to those nations, to that nation to come in and plunder. And again, he says, before the boy knows how to say my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Assyria. So again, within that few years' time, probably within a couple of years in that case.
Yeah.
This is all going to happen. So again, it's the birth of a child. By this time, you know, this is going to happen. Let me see if there's anything else to look at in this. Now, oh yes, he says, and this speaks again to this polarization theme. And again, another verse that's quoted, lots of quotations of Isaiah in the New Testament, because he talks about the Lord Almighty being the one to be, that you should regard as holy. And it says in verse 14 of chapter 8, he will be a holy place for both Israel and Judah. He will be a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. Now,
And a trap.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you think it's as if a rock were put across a road to block the traveler from danger, but actually, rather than stopping, the traveler actually charges ahead and falls over the rock. In a sense,
right? Okay.
That's kind of the picture that God's putting a stone in their way, and they can either stop, they can either see the sign, stop going the wrong way,
or
they will actually stumble over it. It'll become a stumbling stone for them, and so this is, in a sense, Isaiah plays this role, and we see. This is, you know, refers to Jesus in the New Testament, that Jesus becomes either the cornerstone or the rock that makes people stumble.
Yeah,
you know, it's like either people respond positively as the incarnate word that he is, or that he becomes the stumbling block over which people stumble.
Mm.
It's one or the other. This is this polarization effect again. And so he, you know, God says, bind up this testimony of warning and seal up God's instruction among my disciples, so that no one can say, you know, so that when it happens, you'll know that God spoke to you. This is why he's telling it, bind it up and seal it, okay? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it will be recognized that you predicted these things. Mm. And so Isaiah responds, here I am and the children the Lord has given me. We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty, who dwells on Mount Zion. So Isaiah and his children become the embodiment of these signs. But of course, there's hope, Stu. And in chapter 9, you have this famous declaration that this people walking in darkness are going to see this great light. Those living in deep darkness, a light has dawned. And of course, when Isaiah speaks these words of hope, it's light. This is this time vantage point. Mm. He's speaking as though it's already happened, you know, like it's past. You've enlarged a nation, increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder and so forth. He says, every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. Okay, this is because there's going to be peace, in other words. Mm. And then we get the fourth child here in these prophecies. Mm. He says, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given. Again, another child born within the royal household. Mm. And the government will be upon his shoulders. Now, his names, all of these child's names have had some significance, but nothing quite reaches the extravagance of these titles. These aren't just normal titles. No. There's an extravagance to these titles that's quite remarkable, because he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace.
Yeah.
This child is going to be the very incarnation of God himself in a very important sense. Of the increase of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on forever.
Mm.
This is the everlasting kingdom. So Isaiah is looking way beyond, you know, this time to the establishment of God's everlasting kingdom. He comes back to...
Back to judgment again.
Yeah, that's right. We jump back to judgment again. And one thing I just want to point out here, Stu, in chapter 10, again, because remember, we've got this God that is holy, holy, holy. His glory fills the earth. He's God over everyone, right?
Mm, mm.
Now, he says here... He points out that the Assyrian invasion is not out of God's control. In fact, he referred, they're just my tools.
He's using them.
Yeah, but that doesn't also then, that doesn't excuse them from judgment as well.
No.
And in fact, he declares judgment beforehand on the instrument that he's about to use. Woe to the Assyrian, Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath. So that's all you are. You're the club in my hand. He says, I send him against a godless nation. I dispatch him against the people who anger me. I mean, you see this through in the book of Revelation, you see God releasing demons to do his will. In fact, that's not unusual in that scene between Jehoshaphat and Ahab in Kings. There's this scene where this prophet Micaiah sees, again, the heavenly court. And God says, who will go and be a lying spirit in the lips of the false prophets? You know, and you've got the various spirits offering to go. In a sense, there's this sense that God is sovereign over even demonic entities. They can only ever do what God allows them to do. And often, and this is what you see in the book of Revelation, often God... In the book of Revelation, you see God sending, releasing them. These are these scorpion-like creatures to the earth to bring all of the evil on the earth to the surface, to actually bring it all to the surface, which is what you often see see happening. So, in this case, you know, God's just saying, I send the Assyrian king, I dispatch him. But then he says in verse 7. This is not what he intends. This is not what he has in mind. His purpose is to destroy. So he's not doing this to serve God. He's just doing that out of pride.
Yeah, that's right.
But even though he's doing this for his own reasons and out of pride, God says, yet in my sovereignty, this is all part of me. I'm pulling the strings here in a sense.
And if you get to verse 12, the Lord kind of says, you know, the king of Assyria says he's done this because of his own might and his own strength.
That's right.
And really the punishment is because, that's a bit like the axe telling the guy who's whacking him that the axe did the job, you know.
That's right.
No.
Exactly. And so he says there, I will punish the king of Assyria for the willful pride of his heart and in the haughty look in his eyes. But just of course, 20. Then you come back again. You come back again to these promises. Talks about the remnant. The remnant shall return, which comes back to the name of Shear Jashub. The remnant will return. So you know something drastic's going to happen, but God is going to save a remnant, and you get this honing down of who really are the people of God through it. You know, that you're going to get the destruction of the northern kingdom, and this is kind of preparing them for this because they would have thought it unthinkable that God would allow 10 tribes of his covenant people to just sort of disappear.
Destroyed.
So you get down just to this tribe of Judah, essentially. How could this happen? Well, this is how God, he's honing down his people to a remnant. This is already answering that question. And so this is where you get in chapter 11, a shoot will come from the stump of Jesse. Jesse is David's father.
Yes.
So from the stump of Jesse, a new shoot's going to come up. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him, a spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of the knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his bend, so forth. I mean, and then it goes down in verse 19. It says, and then you get that famous
about the regathering of the people.
Read on, the wolf will lie with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them, and so forth and so forth. And it says right at the end there, they will neither harm nor destroy on my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It goes on to say in verse 12, he will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. Now, of course, because they're going to be assimilated into the nations. This is talking about the ingathering of the nations in this very period. Yeah. It's talking about this period.
Yeah.
And of course, the shoot that comes from the stump of Jesse, of course, is Jesus Christ. Yeah. And he is the one that brings this about, that brings this rule of peace, so that the earth is filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And he raises this banner. You know, he raises the banner. It's essentially the gospel, the raising of the banner to gather in all of the exiles from over the earth. And then you get this wonderful response of praise, don't you, from Isaiah, I will praise you, Lord. You know, I mean, it's a beautiful song of praise. So it's really... it's a real roller coaster ride. You've got these, you know, very sobering oracles of judgment. This amazing vision of God who comes with these oracles of judgment, brings this message of judgment, but within that, this strong message of hope that there is a dark tunnel to go through, but there is a very, very bright light at the end of that tunnel.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.